From KCRW, this is DNA Design and Architecture. I'm Frances Anderton. Bird electric scooters are everywhere, but now critics say they're not as sustainable as the company has presented them. How do they respond?
I think that scooters are being held to a standard that is completely unprecedented across the transport space, across the sustainability space, and across the tech space.
More from Bird's head of sustainability coming up. But first, let's step inside a large two-story Craftsman house. Its wood siding and base are painted grey and it has a bright red door. It's on a quiet residential street in Koreatown.
So this was originally a nearly 6,000 square foot home. So we came in here and basically converted and redesigned the space to accommodate this co-living multi-tenant lifestyle.
That's architect and developer David Chun. Passing by from the outside, you'd never guess that this house is serving as a laboratory of sorts. Inside is an experiment in converting pre-existing housing stock into multi-unit housing. This one house has been subdivided into 15 bedrooms with shared dining and common rooms. It adds density without changing the exterior. But not everyone likes this concept. We'll hear why in a moment. First, though, let's go back to the tour. We're standing in a dining area. It's tastefully decorated with modern furniture, a long kitchen island, art by local artists, and food storage for each resident.
The idea of community is very, very critical for co-living. So we do have gatherings on occasion organized by our house manager.
Which is a little akin to the old style rooming houses where there might be a landlady or a gentleman that sort of ran the house and did the cook the dinners and the breakfast. Is it a little bit like that?
It is a little bit like that, but there's no strict agenda or structure about these social events. Like we had a mimosa Sunday, and a couple of our housemates are bartenders. So we obviously got them involved to figure out what the right mix and how to make the best mimosas.
Residents here pay $12.50 a month for a single occupancy furnished bedroom with closet and bathroom, and they have access to a shared living room, kitchen and outdoor patio. Lease arrangements are for 6 or 12 months, though they're referred to here as memberships. David Chun's business partner, Lyndon Chow, explains.
We want to have an all-inclusive price, which includes access to the private bedrooms as well as the common area spaces. And inclusive in that price is also all the utilities, you know, weekly housekeeping services, you know, and other services that we provide, basic supplies, etc.
And the person responsible for keeping those supplies in order is house manager Lani Kim.
I would say mainly I serve as sort of a liaison between all the residents here and then the like management of Co-House, the Co-House team. So I honestly thought that everything wouldn't happen so naturally. Like you would think that with, you know, 15 people in one house, everyone having different jobs, different schedules, everyone just sort of keep to themselves and not really interact as much as they actually do, just because like I'll come back from work, say around 6 or 7, and there will already be like 4 or 5 people in the kitchen. Obviously, they're all doing their own thing, prepping dinner, whatever, but everyone is just hanging out.
In terms of how you select who becomes a resident here, how does that process work?
That process is a tricky one. We do have a questionnaire that we ask everybody to fill out, and we try to do our best to interview them and make sure that you know they're responsible and clean after themselves, and for them to understand that this is not, you know, some party frat house. These are, you know, adults with responsibilities. And once the house starts getting filled like it is now, we do give opportunities to the housemates to have their say, you know, so they can meet them if it's important to them, and it'll give them a chance to interact with them, to have a vote.
You've told us all the amenities that you get, but you don't get a parking space, correct?
Yeah, the parking is very, very limited, and we did have a lot of concerns about that. But we were surprised to find that, you know, I guess perhaps it's the generational difference. You know, most of the people here are in their 20s, early 30s, and a lot of them don't have cars, and we have e-scooters in front of our lot, and people use, you know, Uber, Lyfts, and we're surprised to find that people use different modes of transportation here.
This is David Chan and his partner's second foray into co-housing. His first project is in Highland Park, and it has 9 units. They call the houses co-house, and they'll open their next one soon in West LA. Now, co-housing is a fast-growing housing type in LA, but few of the projects to date are in neighbourhoods that are zoned for single family. They're attractive to newcomers to LA who want to pay less rent and meet new people.
Because, you know, LA, especially for a newcomer, can be a very lonely place. You just travel back and forth from, your home to your office. So there's really not much opportunities to interact aside from maybe your work environment. So I think people here are really interested or certainly understand the value of this idea of building a community, being a part of a community.
Did I hear correctly that there was somebody who moved into the Highland Park property who perhaps was like parties, perhaps a little more than some of the others?
Yeah, we did have a tenant that came in who was a really nice guy, but he was young. He was only 19 years old. And, he loved the place and he came in here thinking that it was a party house. So that became a problem really quickly because he would stay up late and play loud music and have friends over. And we have house rules in place to make sure that people respect each other and respect that quiet time. And we sort of talked to him and said these are the rules, and he agreed that it wasn't the right place for him, and he decided to leave. So that was a real learning process for us as we're continuing to learn it with our second house.
The second house has proven a bit more challenging than expected. For starters, their next-door neighbour is not happy about it. Not happy at all. He's called Peter Gibson. He's in the movie industry, and he sometimes leases his home for shoots. We spoke with him by phone.
Co-housing is a polite way of saying we are skirting around all of the non-existent laws in Greater Los Angeles that can be affected by boarding houses, because they won't call it a boarding house, because that would be affected by the law. I feel bad for the people inside because of the owners doing what they've done. They put these people at risk of, you know, what if there's a fire, an earthquake? There's not sprinkler systems installed. There's no clear fire access points. There's a lot of things that go on in the logistics of an R4 property or an R3 or even an R2 property versus an R1 property. And all these things are taken into effect prior to issuing permits and allowing individuals to build these types of properties in neighborhoods. Those permits and codes are put there for a reason, in order to protect public safety. I am all for the entrepreneurial spirit of co-housing, all for it, in an R2, R3, R4 neighborhood with a designated property that can sustain that type of clientele and people.
Gibson says he has reported the owners to the city's building and safety department. So we asked David Chan if he got a permit to convert this 6,000 square foot Craftsman house into a multi-unit building.
We did. This is a single family house. The building department identifies this as a single family house. And the definition of a single family house, you have one kitchen and you have one entrance. So per the LA Municipal Code, the definition of a family isn't what you might think as related by blood. The definition of a family per the zoning code is basically sharing common spaces, having a relationship, a bond between people. So it's not a traditional definition of a family. It's a much more open definition. And this was caused by, from what I understand, some lawsuits that happened in nearby cities, where to narrowly define family by blood is discriminating.
This is a very interesting option, and it is something that is even maybe being promoted at state level through this bill SB 50, which failed, but is going to be re-presented in some form early next year. And one of the suggested elements of that bill is that single family homes can be subdivided into up to 4-unit buildings. This is obviously 15 units, but it's a similar principle. So we might be seeing much more of this happening all across the state.
I think this is an absolute necessity in my mind. I mean, I think that's why, because Los Angeles is predominantly zoned as an R1, most of the land is taken up by houses. And I think this is the most green and efficient way to create density here. Who needs a 6,000 square foot home? I mean, I'm sure some people do, but I mean, most people don't. And, you know, to be able to create this kind of environment where we can pass on this sort of savings through efficiency and pass this on to our residents, I think that, you know, you speak to our residents and they're ecstatic about the existence of a place like this.
Back to next door neighbor, Peter Gibson.
Do you believe in your heart of hearts right now talking to me that individuals with invested interest in residential neighborhoods are going to be like, oh, yes, yes, in Beverly Hills, I would like the house next door to me compromised into a co-housing apartment building. Come on. But let's say that that all passes. And then basically the city becomes an R2, R3, R4, you know, sort of heyday. You've increased the value of my property. Down the street, the same house goes for $2.5 million. He bought this for 1.28 for a singular reason, because he knew he could get around the laws. If the property was valued at the appropriate value, it would be $2.5 million prior to him even doing any construction for what he bought. But he didn't buy that property. He bought a single family residence with the idea of making it a single family residence. If David wants to flip this entire neighborhood, my house is gone. I will sell it because financially I can move into another neighborhood. I will have made $1.5 million overnight. So if the idea is to destroy historic preservation of Greater Los Angeles and the Craftsman, then, you know, so be it. That's the deal. You can be all for that as a society.
Just hypothetically, what if this was three generations of the same family all living in the house and they'd gone up to 15 members of a family all living in 6,000 square feet? Would that concern you?
I love that question. And that's a very good and valid question, because then it raises the philosophical argument of, you know, what David's talking about. What is family and what is this thing? I have lived in New York City in the Bowery area in the East Village, and there were multiple families living in 1 or 2 bedroom apartments with mattresses on the floor and taking shifts and doing this stuff. And that was a lovely community of individuals really striving to get ahead and working as a unit in order to better themselves and better their family and taking that next step. We both know that this is not that situation, and that this is an opportunistic, irresponsible entrepreneur who has found loopholes in the law in order to give an illusion of kindness and generosity and doing this stuff for the neighborhood. However, that's not the case.
After talking with Peter Gibson, we reached out to the building department and we found that, sure enough, the current certificate of occupancy designates the property a single-family dwelling. The Los Angeles Municipal Code does not currently even define the term co-housing. However, the building inspector has cited the property owners for such things as denying full access, for a breach of fence height, and for installing a non-permitted HVAC system and 4 non-permitted tankless water heaters. While this dispute is unfolding, people are co-living in the house, and we met 2 of them. So, how's it working out for them?
From my personal experience, my only roommate, former roommate, was my ex-husband, so I haven't had a roommate before in my life.
This is Luciana Vakulja.
She's from Brazil. She teaches architecture at USC. And she happened to bring her students on a tour of the Highland Park co-house. While there, she thought, I could see myself living in a house like this. So she was the first to move into the Koreatown co-house. She then found herself the oldest in a group of mostly 20-somethings.
So I think for me, it's been very interesting, but I'm definitely an advocate for how we can densify neighborhoods. Some people are definitely more private. Sometimes they just arrive and go straight to their room. Some are more engaged. They are more open to be engaged in conversation. So, but I feel that everybody has been very mindful in like keeping spaces clean and organized when you use, after using, kind of keeping tight. I think it's being respectful in that sense, yeah.
That's Luciana Vakulja. While she says the age difference is a bit of a challenge and she could use a bit more insulation from other tenants' sound systems, she's generally enjoying her co-housing experiment. So too is Matt Winton.
I'm brand new to LA from Nashville, Tennessee. I graduated from American University in DC last year and actually pursuing acting. So bartending downtown at the SLS Beverly Hills. And came out here primarily to pursue that. And so looked for something quickly, and this showed up on rent.com, and it seemed like an interesting kind of transition from partly from college life. I think I also wanted to stay social when I came here, because I think if I lived alone, I could easily kind of be isolated.
So is the mix of people good? Is the configuration of the house good?
Yeah, no, I love the house. And I think my biggest concern was the people. I think if you move in with, you know, 10, 15 other people and, you know, there's some strong personalities or something like that, and something doesn't mesh, that was my main concern, but that hasn't been the case at all. I actually met Luciana the very first day and she was super welcoming, and that was a big weight off my shoulders.
Could you see this house becoming the location for a reality TV show?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you put like slightly more dramatic people in this setting and then you give them some framework, like something like that, if you really wanted to, I'm sure it would be hilarious.
Well, we did hear about one of the other co-living spaces where they're really going to do kind of an intense version of what you're doing in terms of interviewing prospective tenants. So the people that live in the house already get to vote on who comes in. So it's like voting people onto the island rather than voting people off the island. Were you subject to any kind of interview process by your fellow tenants?
By my fellow tenants?
Yes.
No. They let me in. So if there was one behind my back, I'm not sure.
As mentioned, this is not the only co-housing project out there. You can find variants on the concept being built ground up, but it's fairly unusual to do this in a single family neighbourhood. Now, one person who sees a lot of potential for this model is John Perfitt. He heads Restore Neighbourhoods LA. That's a real estate non-profit that is focused on affordable housing.
I think it's very interesting, and I think that it represents the private market, frankly, and some entrepreneurs pushing forward with innovative housing. I go to a lot of conferences, talk to a lot of people, and there's a lot of talk about innovation and, you know, how we should innovate. And I don't see a lot of action happening. So I respect that people are putting down their own capital and making this happen, because it makes a lot of sense. There's a ton of efficiencies. It doesn't really have a category as far as probably lenders are concerned, or, you know, public officials or planning departments and land use is concerned. And I think it's in many ways it harkens back to another time. It's not new, but it's innovative because it hasn't been around. But it appears to me that there's going to be robust demand for this type of thing.
That was John Perfitt. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. Coming up, Bird e-scooters have ruffled feathers since they took flight in Santa Monica 2 years ago. Well, now the company's trying to fend off criticism about its track record in sustainability by launching a new scooter that is harder to vandalize.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Back with DNA, I'm Frances Anderton. 2 years ago, the e-scooter company Bird launched in Santa Monica. Well, now the buzzy little dockless two-wheelers are in 100 cities and counting. And along the way, they have aroused delight and fury. Critics see Bird and its rivals as VC-fueled tech startups invading civic space. The company has countered that it offers a sustainable alternative to the car that should be embraced by cities that say they want to reduce their carbon footprint. Well, now even the sustainability argument has been rejected by critics in a number of recent articles. So we sat down with Melinda Hansen. She's head of sustainability at Bird. And she pointed out that first, Bird is not just a ride-sharing company connecting people to cars already on the road. Rather, it is a mobility company that makes its scooters.
And my responsibility at the company is to really understand the role that electric scooters can play in helping cities to decarbonize and reach their climate goals, and also understanding what our environmental impact is as a company and doing everything that we can to be as environmentally responsible and sustainable as possible.
And it's a good thing that Bird Rides has you there, because just in recent months, Bird has been criticized on the strength of its commitment to sustainability. It's been charged with making scooters that are not durable enough. It's been charged with transporting them in a way that is using dirty fuels. It's been criticized for the energy that is expended in the actual charging of the scooters. Let's start with the first one, which is the lifespan of these scooters.
Yeah, so we set a very high target for ourselves. The very early model of scooters across all companies that were on the streets were consumer models. So they weren't actually built for the frequency of ridership, to be left out on the streets, to be used so often by all types of riders in a city. And those weren't quite durable. But we have a really sophisticated design team who has been working on our vehicles to make sure that they are sustainable, to make sure that they're durable, to make sure they provide an excellent ride to our riders. And I think our latest model, the Bird 2, really is the pinnacle of innovation in the scooter space.
So tell us about Bird 2, because I understand it's going to take to the roads pretty soon.
It is, yeah. We're already beginning to deploy it in places around Los Angeles and hope to roll it out even further in the fall. First of all, the design of it is incredibly sleek. It's silver in color, and it's a very clean design. It's very heavy and sturdy, you can tell. There's no little dangly bits, you know, no wires, nothing unnecessary on the vehicle. And when you ride it, you can tell with the smooth acceleration, with the overall stability of the vehicle, about what a quality product it really is. And every single design piece has been thought of. And even when this comes to the kickstand, for example, at this point, we're now using a motorcycle kind of style kickstand to make sure that even when you end your ride and you park the vehicle, the scooter itself sits up and sits nice and straight and pretty and stable.
So people can't so easily push them over, since people seem to like pushing over e-scooters.
Unfortunately, I think they should get a better hobby. But yes, indeed, sometimes that happens. And these are very, very stable and stay standing upright.
And these are designed in-house, is that correct?
Exactly. That's exactly right.
But it's really interesting that one of the considerations that you've had to give, you know, real serious thought to is this one of vandalism. Mm. I understand that even this goes down to, say, the placement of the screws, because people will take apart these scooters, and gets to something about people's sort of lack of ownership of these scooters and a feeling that they can, I guess, treat them with impunity or something.
Yeah, yeah. With the design of the new scooter, actually every single detail has been thought of. So there's no exposed screws at all. It's pretty tamper-proof at this point. So the incidence of vandalism, we expect to go down pretty significantly. And actually, you know, I think in any urban space, with any change to the urban environment, there's an initial reaction against it. People don't love to see change. And I think as these scooters become more of a part of our transportation system. People realize how useful they are in their day-to-day life. That interest in doing any harm to the vehicles will go away, and people will realize what an important part of their daily commute and transport ability these scooters really are.
As we've already touched upon, there has been some critiques leveled at Bird having to do with its sustainability. Another piece is disposability of the batteries. Is that something that you're giving consideration to? And what is happening to the earlier fleet of Birds as you bring in a new fleet? Do they get tossed into the landfill? Where do they wind up?
Almost every piece of the scooter is recyclable. So we have service centers when after a Bird is decommissioned, it's completely dismantled, and we work with designated vendors. And we really seek out those vendors who have the highest success rate of reclaiming and reintroducing the raw materials back onto the supply chain. And most components on a Bird scooter are recyclable.
And where will Bird 2 be fabricated?
It will be fabricated in Asia.
Because the other critique has been raised is the transportation of the scooters, that one's moving this seemingly clean mode of mobility miles across the ocean and dirty diesel-powered cargo ships.
So the most important part, actually, if you look at the whole life cycle of the scooter, the most important part of evaluating whether or not it's sustainable is to understand whether or not it's replacing car trips. And what we're seeing in cities around the U.S. is that about one third to one half of all electric scooter trips are replacing car trips. And this really represents the type of important sustainability paradigm shift that's crucial to us succeeding in fighting against climate change.
Are they replacing car trips or are they replacing bicycle trips?
It depends on what city you look at. People take all types of different modes. But I think the most important thing here is that for a lot of people, it's getting people onto two wheels for their very first time. And when we look at the survey results, a lot of scooter riders never ever took a bicycle, never really got on two wheels in a city. And so it's really just essentially a gateway to getting people to consider a new transportation option.
So to maintain that enthusiasm, mm-hmm. the scooter has to be affordable. And yet there's some challenges to the financials of some of these e-scooter companies, and Bird itself has put its prices up. Doesn't Bird now select the neighborhoods where it puts the scooters in, and it will target the neighborhoods where it knows that people can afford the scooter? Are you going to be able to sort of maintain the accessibility to the e-scooter that is necessary if it is to be a sustainable mode of transit?
Yeah. We work really closely with cities, actually, to make sure that we're providing a comprehensive transportation solution. Ideally for us is to be in every neighborhood across a city so that we can make sure people can take and drop the scooters wherever they would like. And that includes placing scooters in historically underserved neighborhoods. We also have a number of different programs to ensure that everybody can get access to a Bird scooter, including discount programs for folks who are on government assistance programs.
Why do you think Bird has been the target of this criticism around its sustainability commitments in the last few months?
I think that people are very interested in scooters, and scooters are being held to a standard that is completely unprecedented across the transport space, across the sustainability space, and across the tech space. I think there's a fascination with them. They're so visible. So people are putting the blame on scooters, I think, because they are a new mode of transportation. But once they become part of the transport system even more, it will be something that people realize really the value of it and embrace it even further.
That was Melinda Hansen. She's head of sustainability at Bird. You've been listening to DNA. I'm Frances Anderton. Avishai Artsy produced and edited the show with a final mix by Ray Guana. Thank you very much for listening. We'll be back next week.